story behind the headlines. Presented by the American Historical Association in cooperation with the National Broadcasting Company with Caesar Searchinger. Each week, Mr. Searchinger, noted foreign correspondent and author, discusses a dominant news event and sketches the historical background leading up to it. You'll be interested to learn that printed copies of these talks are available in bulletin form issued by the Columbia University Press at 10 cents each. $1 for the first 13 issues, $2 for the first 26. Simply address the story behind the headlines, NBC, Radio City, New York. This evening's subject is Appeasement Marches On. We present Caesar Searchinger.
Good evening, everybody. The British government has decided to recognize Franco in Spain. A French mission to negotiate terms of recognition also arrived in Burgos today. Other significant moves in Paris and Madrid foreshadow an early negotiated peace. Such a peace would mean more than the end of the Spanish Civil War. It would mean an important step in the policy of appeasement started by Premier Chamberlain a year ago. Milestones of that policy thus far are the Anglo-Italian Agreement, the Munich Pact, the Franco-German Good Neighbor Pact. A further objective is Franco-Italian Accord, and a preliminary to that is peace in Spain. The road thus far has not been smooth. The journey has been punctuated by raucous cries and violent acts. Alongside it, we see an armaments race, more menacing than anything the world has ever seen. What then, you may ask, is the good of appeasement? And what's behind it all? The root of much of Europe's trouble lay in the late unification of two great nations, Germany and Italy. England and France, the other two great Western countries, achieved unity back in the Middle Ages. Their strongly centralized governments fostered discovery, adventure, overseas conquest, while Germany and Italy, consisting of a litter of petty dynasties, were still torn by internal strife. Thus, England and France were collecting colonial empires, while the German and Italian states were preying on each other, right down to the 19th century. England acquired North America, India, Australia. France, too, occupied parts of America, the West Indies, Indochina, and many island possessions. And when they lost their most valuable American colonies, both of these countries recouped themselves in the newly explored dark continent, Africa. So the colonization of Africa in the 19th century became, to a large extent, a race between Britain and France. France, starting from the northwest, England, starting from Egypt in the northeast, eventually met in the Sudan. When they faced each other at Fashoda in 1898, history for a moment hung in the balance. But war was avoided. By this time, almost all of northern Africa was in the hands of those two countries. Only Morocco in the north and Abyssinia in the east were still independent. Italy had been given two narrow slices of coastland bordering on Abyssinia, Eritrea, Somaliland. Now, Germany and Italy became unified nations in 1870 and 71. The force that united them was nationalism, but once united, they, like the other nations, had to expand. There was a new excuse for expansion, for imperialism in the 19th century. Europe's populations multiplied as never before. The industrial system created a mass demand for raw materials and expanding markets for manufactured goods. But there were no good colonies left for Germany and Italy when they were ready to expand. It didn't worry Germany much, at least not her chancellor, Bismarck, who had recently taken Alsace-Lorraine from France. Bismarck didn't really believe in overseas colonies for Germany. And if he did take some pretty large but not very rich slices of Central Africa, it was with the idea of trading them in rather than establishing an African empire. Bismarck's Germany was a satisfied country, but sooner or later it was bound to burst its confines by dint of sheer energy. It was the Pan-Germans of Bismarck's time, you know, who revived the idea of the historic push to the east. Italy had historic aspirations, too. But hers lay in the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean coasts had been the heart of the Roman Empire, and the Mediterranean Sea was the Mare Nostrum, our sea, to nationalistic Italians from the start. From the very start, United Italy coveted Tunisia, which lay just opposite her southern coast. But she was balked by the French, already in safe possession of neighboring Algeria, who had their own eyes on the old Muslim pirate states to the east. Finally, in fact, wherever Italy turned in Africa, she was balked by France. Finally, in 1881, France took Tunisia from under Italy's very nose, establishing a protectorate with the previous connivance of Britain and Germany. Yes, Germany. For Bismarck thought he would appease France after her loss of Alsace-Lorraine, and so stuck her thinking about getting it back. I'm using the word appease in the Chamberlainian sense. France's action drove Italy into the Triple Alliance with Germany and Austria, which is just what Bismarck wanted. Her greatest humiliation came in 1896, when she first tried to conquer Abyssinia and was defeated at Adowa thanks to France's secret help to the Abyssinians. To appease Italy, Britain and France permitted her to take Libya from the Turks. Libya is a large piece of desert between Tunisia and the west on the west and Egypt on the east. It hasn't been much use to Italy except as a place to keep some troops. Nevertheless, Italy was eventually weaned from the Triple Alliance, and being promised additional territory, she joined the Allies in the World War. When these promises were not fulfilled at Versailles, Italy returned to her anti-French policy, which Mussolini has been pursuing with such gusto to this day. When finally she did conquer Abyssinia, it was in despite of Britain and France, and with the friendly, though passive, aid of Nazi Germany, as Hitler was careful to remind the Duce in his speech the other day. For the second time, Italy had been driven into the arms of Germany, over Africa again, and appeasement was overdue when Mr. Chamberlain came along. Now let's examine the case of Germany. Bismarck's continental policy had given way to the Kaiser's Weltpolitik, which meant colonial expansion and a big navy, which eventually drove Britain into the Entente with France. Wilhelm was out not only for a place in the sun, but raw materials and world markets for Germany's prodigious industries. Good additional colonies could only be had at the expense of Britain and France. The only place in Africa not yet taken was Morocco, just to the west of Algeria. France, in possession of Algeria, wasn't any more eager to see Germany in Morocco than she was to see Italy in Tunisia. But Germany claimed to have interests, and suddenly the Kaiser made a dramatic personal appearance there. There followed much saber-rattling and years of bickering. In 1911, Germany and France were on the verge of war, but Britain supported her Entente partner, and France eventually got Morocco, with a small bit going to Spain. So Britain and France had balked Germany in her colonial aims, just as France had balked Italy in hers. Blocked in the colonial sphere, blocked by Russia in the east, blocked by Britain and Russia in her great Berlin to Baghdad scheme to the southeast, Germany had no place to go. Britain found no way to appease her, and that, in the last analysis, is the reason why the Kaiser went to war. Now let's see what happened after the war. After 14 years of helplessness, when she was ringed about by France's system of alliances, Germany revived with Hitler's rise to power, as Italy had already done under Mussolini. Italy once again voiced her old aspirations. Germany rudely demanded her rights. This time, Britain was determined not to repeat the pre-war mistake, as she thought. To avoid war, the dictators had to be appeased, that is, satisfied at someone else's expense. Now, having temporarily appeased Mussolini by blessing his Ethiopian conquest, Chamberlain secured his guarantee of the Mediterranean status quo. And, having appeased Hitler at the expense of Czechoslovakia, he secured at least temporary peace in the West. If Hitler should be in earnest about wanting the colonies too, well, he could probably be appeased again with bits of Romania, Hungary, Poland, or what have you. Hasn't he said that Germany would expand to the east? That's where England and France have given him a free hand. The important thing was to keep him off colonies, for most of Germany's colonies are now in Britain's hands. The real difficulty, however, is how to appease Mussolini, that is, permanently. With Hitler, you don't know whom the lightning might strike next. But with Mussolini, it's always France. He can't be appeased by proxy, but only at the expense of France. And France has no more intention of yielding Tunisia than England has of yielding Kenya. Of all the things in the Italian theme song, the one only thing worth fighting for is Tunisia. Actually, they have been fighting for it, in Spain. That's where the importance of this Spanish peace comes in. Unless Mussolini can get the kind of peace he wants, his chance of getting anything out of France are slim. Mussolini has been remarkably silent of late. Might this silence be due to the recent backstage moves in Spain? It's a little early to prophesy, but it does seem now that the new Spain is not going to be an Italian Spain. In order to secure British and French recognition, General Franco has already had to do two things. He has had to permit French officers to examine the Pyrenees on the Spanish side of the frontier to see that there are no fortifications or military establishments from which Franco's allies might threaten France. And he has had to promise that the fortified island of Minorca, held till last week by the Loyalists, would not be occupied by anybody but genuine Spaniards. To make sure of this, the British cruiser Devonshire took Franco's representatives to the island, negotiated a peaceful transfer, and took the Loyalist commanders away to safety. The only shots fired in this encounter were fired by Italian airmen from the neighboring island of Mallorca, evidently to express the Duce's disagreement with this surprising move. Minorca, you'll remember, is that very important island, the only fortified point in the Balearics, which lies dead on the route over which France transports its colonial troops and merchandise. France, then, seems not to be threatened either from land or sea, and the much-feared squeeze play of the dictators against the next prospect for a shakedown appears to be off for the time. Not Mussolini, but Franco, it seems, is being appeased, and the methods of appeasement are already drawing the fire of the Italian press. Meantime, Italian troops and German engineers are still in Spain, a problem which may remain to plague both Franco and his newfound friends. On the other hand, large numbers of Italian troops are pouring into Libya and massing close to the border of Tunisia. The meaning of that maneuver seems clear enough, but can Mussolini expect it to succeed? There are indeed vague rumors of something much bigger in the wind, something involving action by all the Axis powers, Italy, Germany, and Japan, another late arrival on the scene of history. Italy mobilizing in the Mediterranean, Germany again assembling its mammoth army as it did last fall, and Japan massing vast numbers of troops on the Siberian border, 600,000 to date, according to one report. Japan, moreover, has occupied the very important Chinese island of Hainan, close to French Indochina. Are all these things part of a vast aggressive project of which the Spanish-French sector is but a detail? Are the Axis powers really getting ready to force a showdown, to challenge the democracies now before the armament race has gone too far? In other words, has appeasement really been a failure? Well, we shall soon see. Unless unexpected events intervene, I shall try, next Friday, to explain some aspects of the situation which directly concern ourselves. Now, I'd like you to write to me sometimes about these talks, as many of you do. But if you do write, don't send any money to me. The money for the copies is sent somewhere else, as you will be told presently. Good night, everybody.
Printed copies of this and last week's talk on American foreign policy are available at 10 cents each. Each week these bulletins contain as well a list of books on the subject of the talk. Cesar Searchinger will be with you again next Friday at this time when he expects to discuss our interests in the Pacific. The program presented by the American Historical Association is an NBC public service feature. This is the National Broadcasting Company.